This is the podcast for Wednesday, October 26, 2011, Ethics. So I just started to make a point about the difference between like the tuition cost, which is like the money that the college charges each of these students, and the actual cost of your education here. Because the tuition is a very small part of the funding for this class, because the state is kicking in tens of thousands of dollars to support just this classroom here. So they're getting money. The state is giving money based on how many students are enrolled. They call it FTEs, full-time student equivalents. And so this represents some portion of your schedule. And for each full-time student or equivalent, say maybe two part-time students put together, the college gets this big chunk of change that goes into its general budget. And so so it's based on enrollment. So the actual cost of your education isn't whatever you're paying in tuition. That's just like a small amount. They used to just call them fees, I think, or something like that. They didn't even call them tuition. So you're at the actual cost a lot higher. It's just that it's borne by, you know, the taxpayers and working people. And so when you get in the job world, you're going to be paying for the next crop of students and probably paying more, because education is going up two or three times the rate of inflation, and it just keeps on going up and up and up. And if you're interested in this topic, and if you would like to participate in a debate, or you know someone who is, on Tuesday, November 9th, there'll be a debate in the south side of the cafeteria where they used to have the cushy couches, where they have that little television set and the vending machines. Students for Liberty is going to be presenting a debate. We have one participant already, and we're looking for at least two more, and maybe we might have four total. So if you're interested in debating, particularly we're interested in someone who wants to make the case for heavy government funding of education. Libertarians tend to think that education ought to be left to the market. But other people say, well, if you leave education to the market, it'll be like, you know, education will be reduced to the level of McDonald's, and you'll have every place will be like Pioneer Pacific or University of Phoenix, which they regard as low-grade education. So, I mean, if that's your view, or if you really believe in, you know, public education, and maybe, you know, stronger funding for education, you could contact them or just talk to me after class, and we'll see if it might work out. So you just have to have that date free and have to be reasonably good in front of an audience. You don't have to be, Billy Graham, or I'm trying to think of somebody else, some person who's known for their public speaking, Bill Burroughs. you don't Adolf Hitler. You don't have to be like. There's the bad people are good at public speaking too. Sure. I won't mention any people occupying partisan political offices, but you know there's you know, you don't have to be a smooth speaker. You just have to be fairly articulate and not like have your knees knock, and be able to speak in a loud, clear voice so people in the back can hear. You'll have a microphone, not have a lot of social anxiety, but, or if you can hide it, you can have all the anxiety you want, I suppose. But anyway, if you're interested in participating, or if you want to give the free market side, or maybe something like right down the middle. We need like a mushy moderate, I think, to even out. We're probably going to get like some extremes, like the libertarian, and then like the sort of probably some socialist from Mossberg will be, you know, presenting. And then we'll have like some middle, we need like some middle of the road person, like a moderate sort of Democrat or Republican or something like that, centrist. Anyway, so if you're interested, talk to me after class or shoot me a Moodle message or email. Okay, so but I was making this point about the actual cost of your education isn't just the tuition, it's a sort of broad thing, and you should think, well, where's the money come from? It's not just coming from me, but it's coming from the state. In the same way, if you think about what's in my self-interest, you see somebody walking down the street with something you want, and you're like, oh, there's a brick right there, and there's a person, and he's got those shoes that I want, but I can't afford. So I'll just pick up this brick, I'll sneak up on him, hit him over the head, and steal his $100 tennis shoes, right? And it might seem like that's in your interest, but somebody like Rand would say, if you think about that long term as a strategy, because that it's not going to serve your self-interest. I think Hobbes would say the same thing, that long term, it's in your interest to live in a free, peaceful, and voluntary society where the government provides law and order, protects life, liberty, and property, and otherwise leaves people free to do as they please. And that's consistent with egoism, because everybody wants to live. Everybody wants safety. Hobbes talks a lot about this. He focuses on safety and security. You want to be secure in your person and property. You don't want to have an angry mob drag you out in the middle of the night and beat the hell out of you and burn your house down. And you don't want that done by the police either, right? So I mean, that's a problem with Hobbes' view, because Hobbes has this view that the government is kind of can do no wrong, and he's a monarchist, which is kind of a problem. But basically, Hobbes said the role of government is to protect you from force and fraud of other people. And I think, actually, I mean, to be fair for Hobbes, I think Hobbes would say, you know, what is the purpose of the government? The purpose of government is to protect individuals. If the government gets really bad and it's not protecting individual rights, then as a good egoist, what should you do? You should say, I'm just going to suck it up, and whatever the government tells me to do, I'm going to do it, and I'm just going to put up with it. No, he would say you need like a revolt, and you need to like get rid of the old king and install a new king. That's what, you know, the people do. When the government gets too oppressive, they have a revolution, and they use force to oppose the king and replace him. Now, Hobbes says if that's happening every week, that's not a good system, right? Because you political turmoil. It's like a third world country, right, where it's the regime of the week. And then the people who are like friends with the old regime all get, you know, put in concentration camps or gulags or whatever, and that's not good either. So you want something that's stable and secure. And I think, again, if Hobbes were around today and he were to see how well the United States and other constitutional republics have done, he would like that system. And he would say, okay, well, maybe the monarchy thing doesn't work out too well. And I was sort of worried that democracy couldn't work. I thought it would be mob rule. As it turns out, that democracies, yeah, the democracy is unstable. A monarchy also is sort of unpredictable because you don't know what you're going to get. So maybe we need something sort of in between, which is a constitutional republic, a nation of laws, which is the sort of system that we have here in the United States. Although, you know, in the last few decades, moving more towards the sort of mob rule type democracy that the founding fathers feared. Okay, so let's talk about utilitarianism today. Any last comments on the egoism? It's so tempting to sort of go back and finish up the slides, but I think what I'll do is I'll send my slideshow thing to the print shop, so you can have like a printed copy of all those things for your notes, so if you just want to stick them in your binder there. And I'll do that as sort of a stopgap measure. I think my notes are fairly explanatory. All right, gotta wait for this to come up because I don't want to fall too far behind. So utilitarianism. So I gave you all of Mill's Utilitarianism to read. Did I give you the whole thing? Maybe I gave you excerpts. I gave you a big chunk of it anyway. The book Utilitarianism isn't a very
isn't a very long book.
Hold on, okay. So this is on
118.
Right, so this stuff at the beginning is my notes, Higher Mental Pleasures. Okay, so I actually started with chapter 2. Yeah, so I just gave you excerpts. This is, you know, in Mill's old hands, so this is, you're not getting kind of the textbook stuff, but you're getting details from Mill himself. It's on now. So utilitarianism is one of the two, I would say one of the two main competing theories of the realist theories in ethics. You often see competition between utilitarianism and deontology. See, this is with PCs. You get all this pop-up crap, and it's like... Now this little tiny thing here. Like on my Mac, it's got this cool thing where you bring the cursor down, and the dock comes up with all these little things, and they get, like, really big. And it's kind of cool stretching effect. So you can actually see him. It doesn't help that this monitor is really tiny. So utilitarianism, deontology, two of the main theories and ethics. Utilitarianism is generally about bringing about the best outcome, and deontology is about following the best rules or respecting people's rights and thinking in terms of rights and responsibilities. So if you talk about, say, making the world a better place, that's kind of utilitarian type thinking and how you go about it. It's a sort of goal-oriented theory. And it says, what you should do is think about, how can I create the greatest happiness, the greatest good for the greatest number? Whereas deontology says, well, okay, you might, of course everybody wants to make the world a better place, but you have to think about the way in which you go about doing that. And you can't try to make the world a better place by violating people's rights and by treating some people shoddily to benefit other people. And there are certain things that you just can't do in any circumstance, whatever the consequences. What's that?
What was that called?
Deontology. That's one of the main theories we talked about in Chapter 1. So it's deontology is the competing theory.
Jefferson.
So we'll be doing with deontology next. Pause this for a second. So utility means net pleasure or happiness. It doesn't refer to what's useful or practical. So that's like the sort of ordinary common sense meaning of utility. That's not what the utility in utilitarianism means. So utility is, Mill uses in the sort of technical term as total amount of happiness. So you take all the pleasures and you subtract all the pains and you get some sort of quantity of happiness. So utility is the total quantity of happiness. Think about it as the profit in the happiness business, right? So you have a business and you take all your revenues and you subtract all your expenses and you get your net profit, right? And so that's what the utility is. So utilitarians will use the term utility or happiness interchangeably. It's kind of a weird use of the word. I think as you'll see as we go on that utilitarianism does focus a lot on the practicalities of life, and they tend to be seen as kind of pragmatists because they're goal-oriented. So according to utilitarianism, your moral duty is just to create as much happiness as possible, and you should use the most efficient, practical, and effective means of doing that. And so the right act is that one which achieves your goal, which is producing as much happiness as possible. And so it's not enough merely to produce some happiness, because if you have two choices, one of which creates some quantity of happiness and another which creates an even greater quantity of happiness, if you go with the lesser happiness, you've done the wrong thing, because you could have done this other thing that would create even more happiness. So it's your goal, your moral duty is to do the best, not just to do pretty good or okay. And certainly not, if you just create more happiness than unhappiness, it's better than creating a bunch of unhappiness and no happiness, but it's still not, you haven't done something right. So this idea that you can go through your life and as long as you don't harm anyone, you've fulfilled your moral duty, utilitarianism would say is false. That a big part of morality is doing things for other people and making the world a better place. And better place means happier place. So now, well, what about, how is this different from egoism? Well, it's almost the flip side of egoism. You get to count yourself, but you only count as one person in the whole wide world. So there might be some reasons to count yourself more, but they're sort of practical concerns, right? So Christmas is going to be coming up in a couple months here, right? So maybe I'll share a crappy Christmas gift you got one Christmas, which where the person had good intentions, but they just totally missed the boat. Now, one thing I'll say about my parents is they never gave me socks and underwear for Christmas. I always thought that the people that got those sorts of things, like, those are the things that parents should just, like, buy for you normally. And Christmas is, like, supposed to be, like, fun stuff. And so, like, socks, that really? Socks and underwear? And people would tell you, show me this. It just seemed so bizarre. So so I remember one time, like, I was a big comic book kid. And so there was this book that was, like, it was really expensive. It was like $5.95, which was a lot of money back in the 70s. And it was Origins of Marvel Comics, and it told all the origin stories of like Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, and the Incredible Hulk, you know, all these old cool comics from like the 30s and 40s reprinted. It's going to be really cool, right? And so I get it and I open it up, and it's like, oh, it's going to be in mint condition, fresh from the factory. Nobody's dog-eared it or thumbed through it, you know. And I get it and I open it up, and I see, like, I'm looking at it, it's just glossy, no wrinkles or anything. But my mom had taken like a black felt-tip pen, and over the $5.95, and she put a line through it. I'm like, So, like, she put a line through the price, which is one of the cool things. Now, if I had this, like, giant soft-bound books with, like, the $5.95, it's kind of like when you, shaving a haircut 2 bits or whatever, right? It's like, that's the resale value that, you know, plummeted to vastly, right? So, it devastated me. But she is well-intentioned, right? It's like, oh, you don't want people to know how much you paid for something. Just put a little black mark there. It's okay. Because she thought she was doing something which would increase happiness, but it turned out it created a lot of unhappiness. So, and you can think of all, like, you know, the fruitcakes and whatever stuff that you get that you don't want. So my wife and I, we have this kind of, I suppose, we're Christmas utilitarians. So the way we do Christmas is, hey, honey, guess what I got myself for Christmas? So each of us will buy things for ourselves. Why? Because we know what we like more than the other person does. And so this increases, you maximize utility, and that you're not trying to guess and play these games and trying to figure out what somebody wants. And so in the same way in general in life, right? You know what makes you happy. Other people, you got to ask them, you kind of guess, you think they know what will make them happy, and sometimes you do the exact opposite thing. I remember I was trying to learn how to build theater sets. So I was doing like a sort of volunteer thing at for the student productions. And I'm just like, I always try to challenge myself and my skills. The guy wouldn't let me, like, in wood shop, wouldn't let me operate the circular saw. He took, like, this old piece of wood and took a hammer and, like, knocked out, a knot in the wood for, like, the hole in my birdhouse and says, here, use this. And I had, like, this toolbox that was supposed to be, like, a rectangle, and it was, like, a parallelogram, you know, just horrible. So I wanted to learn how to, like, do this stuff, you know. And so I'm with this guy, kind of gruff, you know, construction type guy, and I really admire people who have handyman skills. So I go up to him and I say, you know, I hope I'll be some use to you, because I'm just not really good at this kind of handyman stuff, and I just kind of got 2 left thumbs. So I hope I'll actually be some use to you while I'm learning. And he looks at me and says, handyman is someone who fixes toilets. Like, oh, I said the total wrong thing. So here I was trying to, like, show him the respect that I accredited him and how what a great guy he was, and I insulted him by what I said, right? I'm like, oh, so I'm a craftsman. I mean, I, you know, and he's like, that's better. So he just totally started out on the wrong thing. And so, as a utilitarian, you might be able to sort of lean towards your own interests somewhat, because it's really easy to make yourself happy. It's harder to make other people happy, all other things being equal. So, but the thing is, you can't only think about yourself. You can't be an egoist. So there's two parts of utilitarianism. There's the theory of value. So a theory of value is a theory about what is intrinsically valuable or good. what is good in itself apart from what it can get you? There's that old joke, Henry Youngman's old comedian. One of his one-liners was, "What good's happiness? Can't buy you money." Right? And that's, you know, a dry, albeit dry joke. And it's supposed to be funny because money is seen as an instrumental value, something which is good for what it can get you. And you say, "Well, why do you want?" My wife said, "Seems like all you care about is money." Well, you know, when you work for a living, I suppose, you know, you value money more, maybe. But it's not like I have like a fetish for little green slips of paper with presents on, right? It's like, well, I like money because I want to, you know, buy stuff. I want to pay somebody to mow the lawn. I want to go to Comic-Con next year. You know, I'd like to get a massage every week. You know, there's all sorts. I want to visit Costa Rica. There's all sorts of stuff I can do with that money. That would be like, give me lots of like those things that would be fun. I can buy food. I can buy entertainment. I can buy, you know, cool stuff that I'll get lots of enjoyment about. And maybe a utilitarian would say that kind of all boils down to think things are going to make me feel good. They're going to make me happy. And so but you ask, well, you know, someone says, you know, all I really want in life, I just want to be happy. You say, well, why would you want that? That seems, you don't ask the person why they want to be happy. It's assumed that happiness is good in itself. Now, sometimes happiness can get you other things. So a happy worker might be a productive worker. So if you're like the boss at a company, you might want to keep your workers happy because then maybe they do better work, for example. But so you can have something which is good in itself and good for other things. But happiness is one of those things which, even if it didn't do anything else, is something which is just good by itself, regardless of what it gets you. So that's an intrinsic good. So hedonism is the theory that says only happiness or pleasure is intrinsically valuable. And some people make distinctions between happiness and pleasure. I think those distinctions are sort of fine. And when people talk about happiness, they're really kind of taking pleasure and mixing it in with some other stuff. And sometimes Aristotle is mistranslated as saying that happiness is the only thing of value, when really what's translated happiness means something like sort of having a flourishing, successful life. We'll get to him later. But I just think about happiness as feeling good, pleasant thoughts. So if you have some other notions about what it means to be truly happy, you'll put those aside for a moment. Just to understand the utilitarians, when they're talking about positive mental states, good feelings, a feeling of well-being. And now Mill says it's not just physical pleasure though. There is mental pleasure too, and there is aesthetic pleasure. Like today, I was over in the art gallery, and looking at this display they have over there. Go over and check it out there. It's really cool. I was looking at these cast concrete figures that were kind of broken up, and they have moss growing out of them. And they're like laying down there. You look at them, and they almost look like look at the chest. It almost looks like it might be going up and down. But they're kind of abstract because they're made out of concrete and they're not really detailed. But they're kind of creepy, right? And they're supposed to be like dead bodies in a battlefield or something. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool, you know? And I get something's going on in my brain. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. And there's this big mural, and it shows like this big statue with its like head cut off, and the head is like this sort of it's a figure of the god Pan. So it's sort of like an angel's body, but it's got like the head of like a horned human, and it's laying down. And the mural says, "The great god Pan is dead." And you see these little figures of these like goat-headed humans with tails, like leaping off the top, kind of in the shadows. I'm like looking at this thing, like, wow, this is really cool. You know, I like this. This is a quote from a poem about Pan. It's just so, and it's it was kind of cool, and so it gave me aesthetic pleasure, right? Was it like, you know, the same pleasure I got when I, you know, had some of the enchiladas they had in the cafeteria, which were quite good today, and the pasta with cream sauce, you know, that was, I enjoyed that. That's a physical pleasure. But the pleasure that I get from appreciating art is a different kind of pleasure. And it's kind of more of a highbrow pleasure, right? And then there's the pleasure, that Mill even says there are spiritual pleasures, right? That, and so all these things, others. So you shouldn't think that a hedonist is a person who's only interested in like getting drunk, having sex, stuffing their face. No, it's not just bodily pleasures, but it's anything that gives you happiness, anything that creates positive emotional or emotional, physical, or even spiritual sensations is seen as a good thing. So if you help a person in need, right, that would be something which creates happiness. And a hedonist might do that, right? And also don't confuse hedonism with egoism. A lot of people will do that too. They'll think, oh, a hedonist is a person who's only interested in selfish pleasure. Hedonism in the philosophical sense is just a person who says happiness is the only thing of intrinsic value, or pleasure is the only thing of intrinsic value. And although other things might seem valuable in themselves, really they're only valuable because they get you happiness or pleasure. And so you could have an egoist who is a hedonist, or you could have an egoist who isn't a hedonist. Like Ayn Rand would be an example of an egoist who isn't a hedonist. Because she thought that not just happiness was important, but also things like knowledge and art was important, and integrity. So you had all sorts of other values distinct from pleasure or happiness that she thought were important values. Freedom. Freedom's a good example of a value which sometimes might conflict with certain other pleasures, right? So to have a certain kind of freedom, you might have to give up some other pleasure. Maybe I'm trying to think of a case where, what might be a case where you get more freedom if you give up some sort of crass lower pleasure? Well, it might be that freedom's a terrible burden, and that freedom, sometimes being a free person is really tough. There's some quote about this that I can't quite recall, but it might be that being totally free means you have the freedom to fail. And this might be why people in like the Netherlands are so happy. It's because they're taken care of from cradle to grave. And they don't have to worry about being homeless because the government's going to take care of them, even if they totally screw up their lives and get addicted to drugs and lose their job and just like become a sort of unproductive, their life is a wreck. But they're always going to be taken care of. And maybe that gives them a degree of happiness, but you don't have a lot of freedom in that kind of society. Okay, theory of action. So the theory of action, the second part of utilitarianism, is consequentialism. Consequentialism says only the results of an act count as far as morality is concerned. Only the results of an act are relevant to its moral evaluation, or whether it's ethical or unethical, whether it's moral or immoral. You only look at the results. You don't look at the way you got to the results. You don't look at the means, to borrow a phrase from Kant, you look at the ends only. You look at the end result of the action. And so in consequentialism, only the consequences matter, right? Only the results of an action. So if you do a what you might think of as a bad action, and it has a good result, you've done something right. And similarly, the motive of the agent doesn't really matter. So it doesn't matter if you're doing something for a selfish reason, for an unselfish reason, if you're doing something for even a malicious reason. It would say that the only thing that matters if you're going to talk about was the act, the right act, is what the result was. So can you think of an example of something where you might do the right thing for the wrong reason, sort of commonsensically? Maybe a case of doing something which is right, but you're doing it for the wrong reason. Or doing the wrong thing for the right reason, I suppose. Either one. Right thing for the wrong reason. Yeah.
Pull the door open for someone just to check them out.
There you go. So there's a, you know, an attractive member of the opposite sex. I have to say that I kind of like this new trend of, you know, innerwear is outerwear. There's a girl who goes along, she has those sort of geek chic glasses, and she's got like the garters and the sort of some lace around and stuff. I'm like, oh, that's a great outfit, right? You know. So she comes by, and you're like, oh, yeah, hold the door open for her, so you can kind of like follow with your eyes, go through, right? Pleasant to look at. Getting a lot of those heat-ons going on in your brain, right? And you're like, and you're not doing it out of courtesy, you're doing it because you want to leer. Right. Well, a lot of people would say that's, you know, that's immoral, right? Particularly if you're a married man, you should be leery. Or if you're in a committed relationship, or maybe if you're not in a committed relationship, if you're depersonalizing her, treating her as a sex object, you know, bad, 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 right? But you're doing something good for her, right? You're doing, performing a courteous action, but you have you have a bad motive.
Ulterior
motive. There you go. Ulterior motive. That's a good term for it. And you know, you save a drowning child so you can get your picture in the paper. You give money to charity because it's going to be good PR for your business. You join up with the Masons even though you think they're a bunch of nuts because there's good networking opportunities there for your business. So all sorts of cases where you can have a case. Now, what about doing like the wrong thing for the right reason? Again, you're just thinking about the end. What were the end results? Not, you know, what your motive is supposedly is irrelevant. But yeah,
stealing food to feed your family.
That's an interesting case. So the question is, so it's like doing the wrong thing for the right reason. Yeah, so I think people would say that what matters there is not that it's an act of stealing, but what matters there is the outcome is that your family doesn't starve to death, and that the person that you stole the food from lost a little bit of money, but not enough to really hurt. Suppose you like you steal from the grocery store, right? If you steal a loaf of bread and some peanut butter from the grocery store, they're not even going to notice, right? It's going to be a very small effect on them. So the consequence for them will be negligible. The consequence of your family starving to death will be huge, right? So if you get like that peanut butter and bread, lots of calories, right? It's like, get them through another day. Now, a consequentialist, I think, might say that if those are your only two choices, then that's what you should do. But there might be some other choices, that things which would you'll be better for both your family and the store. Like, you know, go to a church first and a church soup kitchen and get some help voluntarily. Or, you know, apply for government aid even, right? Might be preferable to stealing. But if those are the only two choices, if there's no government welfare, if there's no charities, and the choice is steal or watch your family starve to death, the best consequences clearly are making your family survive even if you have to steal. Whereas you get a sort of hardcore deontologist will say it's not really the right action, it's a wrong action. And some might say it's a necessary evil, but some, like somebody like Kant, might say stealing is always wrong. And so you've done something wrong that you should feel guilty about if you steal, even if it's to save your family. Okay, so here's an interesting thought experiment. This is described in the text, but I'll just go over it briefly here. So assume, and this is actually one of the topics for this week. So Robert Nozick, very famous philosopher, Harvard University, the author of one of the best, I think, works of political philosophy in the 20th century, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which I recommend to you. A little sophisticated, but it's... I think it's well worth it, particularly if you want to get wrap your mind around sort of basic political philosophy, or if you're a political science major. If you read John Rawls' The Theory of Justice, which is just sort of an answer to, you're really doing yourself a disservice reading John Rawls without reading Anarchy, State, and Utopia. But this is a completely different topic, the field of ethics, and Nozick has an attack on hedonism. Nozick thinks hedonism is wrong. And so he gives you this thought experiment to get you to think yourself, is pleasure really the only thing of intrinsic value? Is that really all there is to life, is feeling good, being happy? Got here next. Nope. Okay. I want to go back. So he says, imagine the following. Imagine there's a machine you can hook yourself up to, which will give you any pleasant experience you would desire. So if you want to, like, if you're like a sci-fi geek like me, and you're sort of, you would love to feel like what it was like to be a starship captain, right? On a Starfleet ship, right? Or maybe you want to be a Klingon commander, or whatever, right? You can live in your sci-fi world and have, space battles and visit faraway galaxies and go where no one has gone before, and it'd be really cool. Or you could be a secret agent, or you could be a Casanova type, right? Just whatever you could imagine, your wildest dreams would be fulfilled. And any of the unpleasant things that you have in life that you don't like, they just wouldn't be there. So you wouldn't have to worry about, like, doing your taxes. You wouldn't have to, take out the garbage. There wouldn't be any bitter family squabbles at Thanksgiving, Christmas, or, whatever makes your life miserable, right? Some thankless job that you have. You wouldn't have aches and pains if you got those yet, right? So all that stuff would be gone. You wouldn't, like, be constantly trying to lose weight or stay in shape. You wouldn't have to get up to the alarm clock in the morning. So the question is, if you could be hooked up to a machine like that, and that would be your experience, but in reality, you'd be laying in a hospital bed, kind of like zonked out when he's wearing some gadget like that, right? You're just, laying there in a hospital bed, essentially being in a dream the rest of your life. Would you choose that? So what do you think? And if not, why not? You wouldn't?
I would want to be out doing things, not just living a fantasy.
But what's the difference between fantasy and reality, really? Right? I mean, this is an epistemological question, but if you think about it, like, okay, what's the difference between, looking at a tree, right? So you're looking at a tree. What happens when you look at a tree? Well, there's light waves bouncing off that tree, and they're going into the lens of your eye. It's focusing upside down and backwards on your retina. And then it sends impulses to your optic nerve, and somehow your brain turns that image around the right way, and then you have this sensation of seeing a tree. So what if we took that optic nerve and kind of clicked a sensor to it, and maybe we recorded what the tree, we put a little meter on there which recorded these electrical impulses, and it's just like a stream of data. So we took that stream of data, we recorded and figured out what exactly it was, and then we poured it onto our computer, and then we just took another gizmo and clipped it onto your optic nerve and pressed a button, and it sent that same stream of data. You wouldn't know the difference. So the idea is that subjectively, you're going to have all these happy experiences, everything you want to experience. You just wouldn't be doing those actually. So you would have the experience even of writing a best-selling novel, but you wouldn't really write a best-selling novel. You'd have experiences of being a Star Trek captain or whatever your fantasy is, but it wouldn't really be happening. It'd be a fantasy, but you wouldn't know it was a fantasy. All you know is you're happier than you've ever been. Okay. Yeah.
So could we compare that to, say, somebody that went to school and rather than doing the work, they paid somebody else or they cheated or did something like that. They go through the process, at the end they get their degree and they've got it. They go out and work in the field, but all the time they know they didn't really earn it. They cheated or stole their way to it, as opposed to somebody who went through, did all the work, did it themselves, turned it in, got the degree, and went on. Would there be some difference at the end between each of those because of the way they work through the process? And that's what I see here. The image of the tree, although that's very mechanical and biological and everything, sometimes if you're out in nature and you see a tree, there's something else that goes on. And there's a sense of awe or a sense of appreciation for the beauty of it, or how nature all works together. There's just so much going on, and would you experience that if all you knew was the pleasure?
Right, so let's assume, like, whatever experiences you have, you could have, you know, the awe. I mean, that's kind of like it's a feeling, right? The feeling of awe. And there's certain drugs that can create those feelings too, right? That's why people like dropping ecstasy or whatever. I hear that it gives people who are feeling love and connectedness and stuff. So, I mean, imagine for the sake of argument, so I don't want to get into like the scientific question about whether you can reproduce these feelings
sure.
the same. So I want to focus on the ethical intuition.
Okay.
So the question is, if you could do that, and so you would have, so to answer your question about the person who sort of, you know, worked their way, didn't work their way through and got the degree anyway, you would have the experience of having the degree, and you would have the experience of having earned it, but you wouldn't really have earned it.
Right.
So you'd say, yes, you know, I'm a PhD or whatever, and I'm the top expert in the field. You would have the illusion of like being like the smartest man in the world or whatever, but you wouldn't really be. But you would think you were, and everybody else would act as if you were too. But of course, what does everybody else mean? I mean, everybody else is just a simulation, and so we're assuming for the sake of argument that you wouldn't have real relationships, but there would be people in this world, sort of like dream people, right? I don't know if any of you have had like a partner or a spouse, and the partner wakes up with a start and then looks over you and says, "How could you?" And they hit you. And you're like, "What? What did I do? You left me there all alone, right?" I'm like, "I was asleep, like in my dream, you right." So like you would, so that those people wouldn't really be in there, right? They would just be. They would be constructed, but assume for the sake of argument that you wouldn't know the difference. Would that be a preferable world? I mean, you might sort of ask the programmer to sort of, you know, if you want a certain person in there, but they got a few sort of rough edges, you might say, "Oh, can I smooth out those rough edges if you would? Because this person's great otherwise, but I like some changes." Or maybe you want to make a lot of changes. So I mean, why wouldn't you hook up? What would be missing?
Reality.
So what's so great about reality?
Well, you get to share reality.
You'd have the experience of sharing reality.
Interaction as well.
Well, you'd be interacting, you'd have the experience of interaction, just not the reality.
You'd actually be reacting to other people's decisions that they make, like if they have to put forth some type of energy in order to do that.
And how's that different from the real world? I mean, my wife, you know, my wife has a dream. She hits me. I wake up with a start. Somebody's hitting me while I'm sleeping. And I say, "What did I do?" I mean, I didn't initiate that. And we have this back and forth interaction. How would that be different, like in the dream world where, you know, I wake up, you know, next to a supermodel and she says, you know, "Oh, honey, you're the best man I've ever been with," or something, right? Then it's like, I mean, I'd react to that too, but I'd probably have a more pleasant reaction to that. So then, what the question is, why? I mean, generally, if you have a choice between two things, one which is pleasant and one that's unpleasant, you go for the more pleasant one. Like, now sometimes you undergo unpleasant things in the real world. Willingly. Why would you do it? Why would you choose something that's unpleasant? In certain cases.
To gain something better or more valuable or something later on.
Yeah, which, you know, generally speaking seems to be something which is more pleasant later on. So you go through college and you work really hard so you get your degree, which you think is going to give you satisfaction. You work out the gym. There's some people that really enjoy work at the gym. Most people find it to be a necessary evil, but they want to maintain their health. Or you forego eating things that you really enjoy. Why? Because if you ate too much of them all the time, you'd be big as a house, right? Or what have you, right? So you brush your teeth because you don't want a root canal. Because the root canal is really, really painful. Or actually, what's really painful is like right before you get the root canal, and all of a sudden you're laying there in bed, and all of a sudden, you know, you get that horrible shooting, numbing pain that makes your head spin, right? I'm like, oh, I don't want to feel that again. I'm going to brush my teeth really well. So you do, in the real world, you have to do these unpleasant things to avoid, to get pleasant things. Or to, well, you have to do things to either avoid pain or to get pleasure. And sometimes it means a little temporary discomfort in the short term for long-term gain. Or at least to avoid long-term pain. But in this experience machine, you don't have to worry about all that stuff, right? Think about like a Star Trek episode, right? So, like, think about the real Captain Picard. Imagine there's a real Captain Picard in some parallel universe, right? Is he, you know, does he all spend all his time like, you know, on adventures? No, probably a lot of it is like boring stuff. He's got these reports to look at. Like, usually you have a scene, and maybe he's in his office, and he's got his little data pad there, which is, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, back in the late 80s, you know, they have these little sort of iPad-type devices, right, which are real now, which is kind of cool. You think about someday there will be a Star Trek world. But he's kind of, like, going through his little touchpad screen there, and he's probably going through some boring business reports, right? But that's, like, 2 seconds of the scene, and then somebody comes in and, Captain, we have a problem, right? Oh, here's the excitement. But it's like the real Captain Picard, he's, like, there for hours saying, oh, God, these personnel reports and all. Being a captain is all this administrative crap that I have to deal with, you know. It's, you know, and that's not very exciting. So in your experience machine, you cut all that boring stuff, and you get the exciting part. And maybe you'd have a combination of like sort of rising and falling action, like in a good movie, right? There's some scenes which are sort of intimate and dramatic, and then you get an action sequence, and there's a car chase, and then it's the hero's pouring out his soul to maybe his buddy cop partner, and then something else happens, exciting. I mean, so you can have variety, but it would be a variety of interesting, exciting things, not like boring or painful things. And, you know, in the experience, think about all the things that you wouldn't have to put up with. Your dog dying, finding out you got cancer, finding out that your only daughter was killed in a car crash, being betrayed by your best friend, and find out that he's been sleeping with your wife or whatever.
It's a perfect world machine.
Yeah. This is stuff that happens. I mean, stuff that happens in the real world. I mean, lots of bad stuff happens in the world. Getting old, right? Seeing those wrinkles, getting the arthritis and the diabetes and all that stuff. Yeah. You have your hand up? That's a good question. Some people will say, well, look, there's no sort of contrast. So I asked this question. So I had this delicious lunch today. I had it was like an enchiladas and this pasta with cream sauce on. It was pretty good. And I had these vegetables. Now, if I had to rank those, I'd say the enchiladas were like really good. And then the pasta with cream sauce was okay, a little sweet, kind of bland. And then the vegetables, a little less, right? But I still enjoyed eating the vegetables. And the vegetables are a contrast in their flavor, in their texture. They're kind of crunchy. They got more moisture. And then the pasta is a little more sweet, and the enchilada is kind of spicy, right? So I have all those different tastes, and they all contrast with the rest, but they're all pleasurable, right? Now, what if I... too much pleasure going on here. I need a contrast. I'll rummage through the dumpster and see if I can find like a week old, like... what would be something that would really, 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 really terrible tasting like after a week?
Deep
like
dish.
An old banana. Like totally black banana with a greasy peel that's been sitting in that dumpster.
You're not
maybe
right,
like
Professor, he's not right.
Now it's been, it's like, you know, like in a corner, so when they dumped it out, it like stuck to the bottom. So I get like a spatula and kind of like push it up and I put it on my plate there. And I eat like not just the inside, but I eat the peel too. I'm like, oh, this is disgusting, right? And then I eat my enchilada and say, ooh, this is so good now. It's like you don't need to like give yourself a really painful experience. Or like think about like I don't really maybe appreciate the freedom that I have in America. So maybe what I should do is go out and commit like a property crime that would probably give me like a range of like 5 to 10 years, right? So I spent 5-10 years in prison, and like, you know, I can't close the door when I use the toilet, and I have to wake up at the same time. There's bright lights shining down on me all the time. I'm in a confined cell 23 hours a day. I'm like, oh, I wish I could be free. And they let me out. I'm like, wow, being free is great. I can close the door when I use the toilet, and I can go wherever I want. I can sleep whenever I want. And isn't this great? But then, like, the thing is, like, I had to put up with being in prison for 5 or 10 years. Is that worth, like, the extra kind of, wow, this is really cool? It seems like you'd lose, right? I mean, you'd come out on the losing end. Because the sacrifice would be so much pain, and the increased pleasure might just be just, you know, some. I mean, it might be a lot at the beginning, but then overall it'd be bad. But as long as you have contrast of things, like, eating, you know, a piece of bread is pleasurable when you're hungry. It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to be like a. You don't have to eat some. Eat like. Should I like? I don't know. I'm beating this to death. Should I drink spoiled milk every morning to make the rest of my food taste good? Anyway, so it might just be degrees of pleasure might be enough to keep your life happy. Make it out sort of like maybe some people I think is sort of mildly unpleasant things. Like, you know, like. Well, there's this joke, right, about there's a guy standing on a street corner with a 2x4, and he's hitting himself over the head over and over again. And you go up to him and you say, why are you doing that? And he says, because when I stop, it feels so good. So that's that sort of the same sort of idea that you sort of inflict pain to feel better when you stop the pain. But there might be something to, like, okay, like, maybe you want to program in the thing, like, you really like getting, like, having the neck rubbed. And having your neck rubbed feels really good when your neck is sore, not as good when your neck isn't sore, but it still feels good. But maybe what feels really good is when your neck's like really, really stiff and somebody's like really good at rubbing your neck. And you're like, okay, so I'll put in like stiff neckness. Yeah. Why? Because it gives me overall greater pleasure. Because having a stiff neck is really mildly unpleasant, but when someone rubs it, it feels really, really good. So you can program in that, sure. But you wouldn't program in, you know, I hate to break the news to you, Bob, but you know, all those years of smoking, you have lung cancer. You have 2 months to live. Or, you know, I saw Helen out with Joe last night, and they were checking into the motel. Or, you know, all those terrible things that happen to people. And in America, like, there's a lot fewer things happen to people here than other places. So we have it pretty good here overall. So other thoughts about the experience machine? Did it change anybody's mind? Why wouldn't you hook up? Yeah.
My kid, I mean, you can program them into the world and they're amazing, but I have really helped. I mean, experience is watching my kid grow from reality to experience life is more important to me.
Well, you would have the experience of seeing your kid grow up, but it wouldn't really be your kid.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I think Nozick was trying to get you to key on that there's more to life than having pleasant experiences. And so he'd say things like your relationships with other people, and not just like the way that the relationship feels from the inside from your point of view, but the actual relationship is something that's intrinsically valuable. He would say like having freedom. And be able to develop your talents, to be a productive person, or even knowledge. There's no knowledge in this. So to be able to learn. I mean, learning is hard work. It's unpleasant, but people do it anyway because they think it's worthwhile. And sometimes people will try to learn things because they're difficult, or they'll try to do things because they're difficult. And I suppose there's a certain amount of satisfaction that comes afterwards. But people generally don't think, I'm going to do this thing so I can be satisfied at the end. They're thinking, I'm going to do this thing because I find it to be a challenge. And I think it's worthwhile to meet a really high challenge, even though it's really tough. Like and people that perform art, right, or that create art. I guess there's performance art too. But people who create art, a lot of artists are like unhappy people. You get the sort of tortured artist, right? The stereotype of the tortured artist living in poverty, trying to create something underappreciated. And the idea is, in the mind of that person like that, art is something which is valuable for its own sake, for what it expresses, for what it says, even if it expresses pain and misery, and even if it's really painful when you're creating these things. Okay. Utilitarianism. So utilitarianism was actually founded by a Jeremy Bentham. John Stuart Mill is sort of synonymous with the term utilitarianism, but Bentham is the guy who actually came up with the theory. 1748 to 1832 for a reference there. Contemporary of David Hume. So he's the founder. And he created something he calls the hedonic calculus. And the hedonic calculus, he has this idea that you add up all the pains that an action would produce, you add up all the pleasures, and then you figure out, you give it some sort of number. So you say, okay, how much pain would this cause? How much pleasure would this produce? And so you get like a net number of how much pleasure overall it would produce when you take out the pains. And then you compare it to lots of other things you might do, and you pick the one that's going to have the highest value. The hedonic calculus. Hedonic meaning having to do with pleasure. Hedonism is the view that pleasure is the only thing of intrinsic value. Hedonic means having to do with pleasure. And I might occasionally talk about hedons as like kind of a unit of pleasure. If you want to sort of roughly break into quantity, you might say a hedon, like if I scratch an itch, a mild itch that I have, maybe it's like, you know, 2 hedons. If I shoot heroin in my veins, maybe I'll get 1,000 hedons, right? If I watch The Walking Dead this weekend, maybe I get, you know, 20 hedons. So you sort of, it's kind of like a rough intuitive scale of how much pleasure a given action might produce. So Jeremy Bentham presides over every meeting of the College of London to this very day. No college business can be conducted without his presence. How does he do that? He must be really old. Oh, yeah. He died in 1832, but he's still got to be there. They keep him actually in a glass case. I think they might have moved him out to the hall, but he's still got to be there. And the college bylaws still say that his, you know, presence is necessary to have a quorum.
Did I read somewhere they had to replace his head several years ago?
Yeah, so actually his head is kind of scary looking. So this is the wax head that's on top of the body. The other head, the actual head's in a burlap sack underneath the chair, and it's pretty scary looking. So you can see this guy's kind of like a character, right? It's particularly doing something like this in the 19th century, early 19th
century.
Would
they do a mummy or something?
Yeah, so it's a wax head. You know, it's like a sculpture based on him. So they were the actual head was starting to look kind of scary looking, so they replaced it with this wax replica. So kind of a joker. So Bentham is the real founder of utilitarianism, and he's a social reformer. And so he wants to change society, and he's reacting against the stratified English society. So he's an Englishman, and you have sort of the vestiges of the English monarchy. I guess you still have the English monarchy. But you have a parliamentary system at the time. So they went from having like a king and a bunch of nobles commanding the people and peasants being, you know, ground under the heel of the king. And sometimes the kings weren't that bad. Other times they were really bad. So you had sort of a mix. But the common people didn't have any power. And there's lots of poor people and lots of rich people. And the poor people don't have any opportunity for upward mobility early on. So this is when things are kind of changing, but still you have lots of poor, uneducated people that have no opportunity, and you have a lot of rich landed aristocracy. And so Bentham thought that if you're thinking about what the best society is, you want a society which does not just support the few, you might say the 1% in today's current lingo, right? You need to think about the 99%, the greatest good for the greatest number. And so he created this hedonic calculus as a practical way of thinking about maximizing utility. So if you think about the sorts of things which will make society better, you're thinking about like government policy, you should consider all the pain you'll create, all the pleasure you'll create, and try to pick that action which will produce the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. So it's all about maximizing utility or happiness. And he thinks on a personal basis too. When you lead your daily life, you should think, okay, well, how much pain will this produce? How much pleasure will this produce? Not just for me, but for people in general. So, and he says when you're doing this calculation, there's three basic things to consider. So first you have to consider how intense the pleasure is. So somebody give me an example of like a really intense pleasure. What's a pleasure? What is intense? What does intensity mean? He's like, there's a lot of it. It's like there's a lot of it, right? Think about like the volume control on the amp. Like a really intense one is when like it goes up to 11, right? So what's an example of intense pleasure?
Roller coaster ride.
Roller coaster ride. There you go. What else? Some people find that painful and get sick or something. But yeah, it's like a lot of excitement, right? Good adrenaline rush. It'd be pretty intense, right? Maybe it's like, whoa, that was intense. That'd be an 8. Maybe if you really like, well, you're really into roller coasters, that might be a 9. What about sex, right? Sex, a lot of like intense pleasure, right? If you're doing it right. Especially near the end, right? A rush of intense pleasure. What about shooting heroin into your vein, right? Really, you get a big rush. What about duration? What's a pleasure that's very long lasting? Well, not sex, right? Sex is something that depends on how adventurous you are, but after a certain point, you're like, you're doing it right, you've been at it too long, right? So sex is a good example of like really intense pleasure, but very short-lived. But then there's like kind of mild pleasure that lasts a long time. What about like that sort of kind of quiet feeling of satisfaction you have in a long-term monogamous relationship?
Like you say, for example, where artists are drawing, painting.
Yeah.
Writing music or something.
Sure, so enjoying music, right? Might be something you can do for a long time. A lazy Sunday afternoon, you might put on some Wagner and listen to it. You listen to the whole Ring cycle, right? Till evening. And you're still not done, but at least you heard a big swath of it. And like, so you can do, there's certain things, pleasures that can last a long time. It may not be that intense. And then this third one is fecundity. So fecundity means fertility. So it's something, you think about this sort of like an agricultural thing. So you have like fertile soil. So a fecundity means the capacity to grow something. So a fecund pleasure or a fertile pleasure is one which has the possibility of creating other pleasures. So what might be some pleasure that if you engaged in it would lead to other pleasures down the road? Something you do that would make you happy, but it actually create future happiness just as a byproduct. You think of something you would do that would be like that? Yeah. Cooking. There you go. So if you really enjoy cooking, you like sort of creating in the kitchen, you like kind of mixing things and being creative, right, and creating, making your culinary creations, you create something and then you get to eat it and it's even more pleasure, right? So you get pleasure from cooking it, or you might get pleasure from other people eating it and complimenting you and telling you how great you are. Or you might just get a feeling of satisfaction that you're making other people happy, right? So that's a good example. Helping other people, I guess, would be an example. How about exercise? I mean, some people tell me they like exercise. Maybe like play, if you like play a sport, right? So it's a good way to keep in shape, play racquetball or tennis or whatever it is, fencing, martial arts, whatever you do. And that's something which you might have to be really fun to do, right? but also it keeps you in shape. So it, and maybe with the martial arts that might be even better because you get exercise. It's fun when you do it, and then maybe if you know you're attacked in a dark alley someday, you'll be able to defend yourself. So it's like you have all sorts of payoffs there, things which will make you happier. And so he says you have to consider all of these things and then kind of figure out what the what creates the most pleasure. Okay, John Stuart Mill, he's developed utilitarianism into a popular system. So he's the person who's kind of identified with utilitarianism. He's the person whose name is identified with utilitarianism, not Bentham. A lot of people, they'll take an intro ethics class and they don't even talk about Bentham. Mill really took Bentham's theories and kind of popularized them and made them, made it into the dominant, one of the dominant moral theories. Some would say the dominant moral theory. And so his name is seen as synonymous with utilitarianism and not really Bentham's, even though he didn't come up with theory. And Bentham has some interesting facts about his biography. He was a child prodigy. He was learning Greek and Latin when he was like 5 years old. He was homeschooled by his father. His father wanted to be a lawyer, and he disappointed him by being a philosopher. Not unlike my own case. He kind of worked himself to death early on. I think this was before he decided to go for philosophy. He had a mental breakdown. He was just sort of never had a childhood, never went out and played. He sort of was always steady, steady, steady. He had some sort of a mental breakdown in, I think, his early 20s. After that, went into philosophy. So there's an objection to utilitarianism that it's this crass hedonistic philosophy. And what Mill says is he's got this little this concept of higher and lower pleasures. He says some pleasures are better than others. Not all pleasures are created equal. So there's quantity of pleasure, like how much pleasure, how intense, how long did it last, did it create a bunch of other pleasures. But there's also quality. What was the quality of the pleasure like? And if you think about this as being sort of like pizza, right? You can get like a cardboard tasty pizza from like Little Caesars, right? A $5 cheese pizza. It tastes okay, but you know, it's kind of not a lot of cheese and it's not that great and the crust is kind of hard. Or you can get like sort of a fancy gourmet pizza that maybe you pay $20 for. And that's going to be like really high quality. So now, I could get four $5 pizzas for what I paid for the $20 gourmet pizza, right? So I got more pizza here, right? Does that mean that I've created the most pleasure? And he would say, no, there's something like the quality of the pleasure. Now, what does he mean by the quality of the pleasure? Well, this is different than Bentham, who just says it's intense, intensity, duration, and fecundity. For him, it's the quality of the pleasure matters. And he defines the quality, so it's different from Bentham's calculus. He defines the quality as, let's see if I got this here, as being different for different kinds of pleasure. So here's what he says. He says, it's better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. So not all pleasures are created equally. And we know that some pleasures are better than others because people who are familiar with both prefer the higher pleasures. So you take an educated person, and he says an educated person isn't going to spend all their time swilling hard liquor, carousing with the ladies, and gorging himself on food. He's going to want to read a book every once in a while. He's going to want to go to the museum. He's going to go to the library, go to the opera. He's not going to be down at the pub every day singing drinking songs and getting drunk. And the idea is that you get people who are more cultured, more refined, more intellectual, that are sort of have experienced both, you know, and it's like this guy never has sex, right? And it's not like he's never tasted a pint of cheap beer. It's just that he's experienced the sort of lower bodily pleasures, but he recognizes the importance of the higher loftier pleasures. And Mill thinks that we know that they're better because people of refinement of education prefer them. And that's why they're called higher pleasures. I'm sorry, there's a lot of verbiage. You can't get all this down. This PowerPoint will be on Moodle if you need to fill in the holes. I just got a couple of minutes here, so I want to get to this last bit here. So we know all pleasures are not... that some pleasures are better than other because others because people familiar with both prefer the higher pleasures. So, So the higher pleasures are intellectual and cultural pleasures. Going to the museum, going to the opera, and listening to classical music, we might say, right? That's a higher pleasure. Going to the art gallery, playing chess. Reading a philosophy book, doing a math problem or something. I have time for my math professorship. Some people really do enjoy doing math. I have a friend who's a math professor and he's like that. So intellectual and cultural pleasures which engage the mind and engage the aesthetic senses, your artistic sense. And then there's the lower pleasures. And the lower pleasures are physical or bodily pleasures. Sometimes they're sort of, you know, emotional pleasures. But it's the kind of common blue-collar pleasures. And in Mill's day, I'd be going down to the pub and drinking ale and carousing and gambling, you know, playing games of chance, gossiping with your friends. Today, we might say watching sports, like watching a football game and swilling beer, and playing video games, right? Watching like a cheesy action movie or a schlocky horror movie. Watching professional wrestling or, Jersey Shore, right? Or some really awful reality show on Fox. Right? So all these shows, they sort of play the lowest common denominator. So these are the lower pleasures of the masses, the kind of blue-collar pleasures. Again, Mill says these aren't necessarily bad, but they're not the higher pleasures. So they have their place, but really a rounded person, you know, a hedonist is not going to only focus on these because these are not as high as quality as these other pleasures. And so he would say that you shouldn't be like a proverbial pig wallowing in the mud, and a good utilitarian won't do that. A good utilitarian will recognize the higher pleasures deserve more attention and focus. So we'd say that the argument that utilitarianism is a philosophy fit only for swine is a false a criticism, undeserved criticism. Okay, so that's it for utilitarianism for this week. We'll do a little more on utilitarianism next week, so make sure to post the forum before Sunday, 11:55 p.m., and I'll see you on Monday. Okay. Yeah, okay.